Hi, I'm Henat Baba, host of Cross Currents. Just a few times a year, we ask for your support, and now is the time to do that. It's our spring membership campaign. So if you like what you hear on KALW, make a contribution now at KALW.org and click donate. Thank you.
KALW.
We wanted a space where people could cry and could rage and could sing and dance and just be still and be quiet and eat and break bread together.
Today, a 14-hour marathon event of learning, performance, and solidarity.
The question of what does our art do in these moments, like in a moment like this, a moment of televised genocide, it made me ask, what is the purpose?
Making art to meet the moment. Then we hear what it's like to be Black in Humboldt County.
It's a heavy load to carry, and you also have to know how to navigate predominantly white spaces. So I often think about, if it's heavy for me, what kind of weight are my other brothers and sisters carrying?
Stories from the KALW Audio Academy, past and present. That's coming up. I'm Henat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The ongoing Israeli attack on Gaza has left 1.7 million Palestinians displaced, more than 12,000 children killed, and 70% of Gazan homes destroyed. And a lot of that destruction has been streaming on our devices, day and night. In this moment, many artists are asking, how do you make art, dance, or perform in the face of live-streamed atrocities? In 1963, after the release of her song, Mississippi Goddam, musician Nina Simone offered one answer.
An artist's duty, as far as I'm concerned, is to reflect the times.
And that's what a group of Bay Area dancers did with a 14-hour marathon event of learning, performance, and solidarity. KALW's Lina Nadia Basuni has been grappling with these questions, too, and she attended the event to learn what it means to make art in this moment.
At 9 a.m., Styles Alexander pulls up to Counterpulse, a performance and event space smack dab in the Tenderloin. The sidewalk is covered in blood. Styles was told that someone had fallen and bled out on the street.
In a way, it was painfully metaphorical for what we're doing here, just to be literally cleaning blood as we're trying to sort of clean up the blood that our nation has made with our hands.
We're outside the event, Artists Against Genocide. It's a marathon of performances, teach-ins, and actions in solidarity with the people of Palestine, Sudan, and the Congo. Styles is an artist and dancer and calls themselves the instigator of the event.
The question of what does our art do in these moments, like in a moment like this, a moment of televised genocide, it made me ask, what is the purpose?
I've been asking myself the same question. How can I create anything when right now I don't even know how I'm supposed to put one foot in front of the other? As an Arab, I cannot separate myself from these atrocities. Every day I visit countless graves, as all our phone screens become cemeteries for the more than 30,000 Palestinians who have been killed. Styles, like me, forgot how to make art. But then they talked with other artists and had a realization.
We came to this conclusion that, you know, artists are actually the first responders in so many ways.
In thinking about how to respond, Styles and their community started talking not just about Palestine, but also the thousands and thousands killed in Sudan and the Congo.
So for me, it was less about what can performance do as much as it was like, what else do I have? What else do I have?
Styles glides me through the corridors. There are three floors with films and sound baths, phone banking and food, poetry and performance workshops.
Go, one, give me a second. One, two, three, four.
That's Redessa Jones. As founder of the Medea Project, she leads storytelling workshops for incarcerated women.
Dancing.
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 Is defined as
any
movement.
Today, she's on the stage at Counterpulse, teaching us the first step to making art in times of trouble. Speak, she says, as a chorus.
I believe that liberation is within our reach and revolution is at our throat.
Another organizer, Chibuise Crouch, reads a poem as a tight circle gathers round her.
I believe.
I am a bird.
I am a bird.
I dream.
I dream.
And it's a
together, the chorus speaks as they point their fingers high to the sky. It reminds me of how I was taught to bear witness. My family raises their fingers just like that when they pray.
Dance, for me, is prayer.
Like Styles, my family taught me prayer and dance were done better together. Today, it seems dreaming and praying and witnessing share the same meaning. As I listen to the chorus, the voices sound like a flock, and I imagine the words of Palestinian poet Marwan Mahoul. He says, in order for me to write poetry that isn't political, I must listen to the birds. And in order for me to hear the birds, the warplanes must be silent. But the warplanes aren't silent right now. I ask the question again, can you dance? Should you dance? Styles says in this moment, if the first step for artists is to use art to connect, step two is don't dance to escape.
People don't want to see a bunch of people just performing and dancing around when people are dying. We wanted a space where people could cry and could rage and could sing and dance and just be still and be quiet and eat and break bread together.
I move backstage as musicians start to play and call the audience members to join them. The bass of the music and their stomps shake the building and move up through the soles of my feet. A familiar feeling rushes over me. The feeling of being carried in a crowd as I march in the streets. Of chanting in unison. So, we're speaking as a chorus, and we're not dancing to escape.
And we are in one of the most well-documented genocides, literally.
That's Sharif Zakut from the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, a featured speaker of the teach-in.
Literally, we are seeing play-by-play on cell phones, people we are hearing from, and with over 30,000 people dead, over a third of them children, over 7,000 people who have left unaccounted for, suspected to be killed under rubble.
In this talk, he shows me what step three is. Ground your art in education. He emphasizes how worldwide struggles are interconnected. And Chibuise Crouch says the organizers were adamant about this point.
It just felt like having this panel and having a teach-in where we had representatives from Palestine, Congo, and Sudan would be a really tremendous moment for solidarity to connect the dots and kind of understand the ways that all these violences are connected and all these systemic genocides are part of a larger system of imperialism and colonialism.
Even educators know that in times of atrocity, in order to endure, we need to pause and offer up prayer. Writer and doctoral student Shah Noor steps back during her teach-in on Sudan to do just that.
I just want to do a prayer for the children of Sudan and of Palestine and of the Congo and of all places that deserve safety and love and just care and life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Shah recites Surah Al-Fatiha, the first chapter in the Quran. I too have it memorized, and my lips follow her prayer like a chorus.
I dream.
I dream.
And it's a beautiful
my mother taught me to pray and dance in the same breath, how to move my body not just in bursts of joy, but also to carry me through waves of grief. Maybe the key to making art in times of trouble is not to let go, but to hold on tighter. If artists are, like Styles says, the first responders, then maybe a day like this one is the antiseptic in their first aid kit. A day filled with presence, connection, and education.
a day which draws on the possibility evoked by performance. It makes way to see the wound, to know what is needed to heal. In San Francisco, I'm Lena Bassuni for CrossCurrents.
Lena reported that story as a fellow in KALW's Audio Academy. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Our last story was reported by Lena Najia Bassuni, a current fellow in our KALW Audio Academy. The program has graduated 9 classes of fellows who've gone out into the world of journalism with a foundation that began here in our newsroom. Fellows have gone on to work in newsrooms around the country. Some are award-winning journalists today. Some have started their own projects. And some have stayed or come back to KALW to pursue journalism in our newsroom. We are so proud of our fellows. And we love it when we see former fellows out in the world reporting, doing their thing their way. That brings us to our next story from former Audio Academy fellow Kelby McIntosh. He's now part of the KALW Local News Fellowship at UC Berkeley, reporting for Access Humboldt. In this story from his show, The 23%, Kelby explores being Black in Humboldt County with Monique Desir, founder of an organization called Black Humboldt. Here's Kelby.
Nestled between a Jamaican spot and a skateboard shop in Old Town Eureka, I found myself walking down a cramped hallway of stairs to meet Monique at the Black Humboldt office. Mo has lived in the county for some years and gave me a realistic rundown on what I might expect living in Humboldt. She painted a vivid picture of the need for reporters of color, so I felt inspired to have my work impact a new area.
I think the area is eager to show a face of equity inclusion. So there's a lot of diversity hires because recently I've seen a lot of Black folks transplanting here from places that I'm like, why would you leave there for here? And I mean, maybe most likely they're unaware of what the social climate is here.
Cash Money Records taking over for the 99 and the 2. I'm from Marshall, Texas. I found joy in hot summers, bombarded with the sounds of dominoes slamming on tables. I fell asleep to the sounds of Texas nights, tucked under a blanket of stars, and the smell of barbecue that make your mouth water. But like Humboldt, it has its own issues with equality and racial tensions. Growing up, I felt like my mother and granny held the knowledge of the entire universe. They gave up a lot to ensure I didn't become a statistic and was fully prepared to tackle life outside of their care. I started my career as a comic book artist, so becoming a reporter in Oakland and relocating to the Lost Coast is far from what I imagined I'd be doing. Much of my early reporting covered the homeless crisis and how it impacted people of color. I begin to find comfort in having personal conversations with people in a place that is extremely diverse. I've recently learned that people of color make up just under 30% of Humboldt County's population. Within that, Black people total less than 8%. So I wanted to know, why would a person of color come here?
Truthfully, I think people wind up falling in love here. And so they have family nearby, if their partner's from here. Cousins or family that are coming because they are saying like, well, we're here, you know. I used to think it was just like a happy little liberal town. And then when I moved here, I was like, oh, no Black people are here.
I see why many people love this place. It's a nature lover's paradise. But it's hard not to feel like I'm on an island when I'm passive-aggressively mistreated as a Black man, which forces me to focus less on myself or the landscape and more on how I'm perceived. I can't shake the feeling I got from overhearing a white couple talk about how humble to white paradise. It's a weird mix of sadness, anger, and accepting that you're ostracized. It's a one-dimensional hierarchy you don't have the privilege to ignore when you're a minority.
It's a heavy load to carry, and you also have to know how to navigate predominantly white spaces. So I often think about, if it's heavy for me, what kind of weight are my other brothers and sisters carrying? And it kind of means that you're not going to see much of yourself, that you might have to be the spearhead for the things you do want to see.
I do agree with Mo. It's a heavy load to carry. That's why I've turned to weightlifting to distract myself, because fitness has helped me find some form of community. I've learned from my personal trainer that finding acceptance is pretty hard for transplants of color. The gym has become my neutral space, like two generals signing a ceasefire. I wanted to double back to a point that you made about Humble tries to portray itself as the all-inclusive place. How do you feel about these kind of portrayals?
I'm anti-performative allyship, for sure. I was like, dang, they had me fooled because of these rainbow flags and whatever else they have on their lawn or their bumper stickers. And working at Black Humble, we get like anonymous phone calls. We're called porch monkeys, N-words, called anti-white, which I'm like, my mama is white.
After listening to Mo speak, it's clear that she doesn't mean every white person, but more of.
It's like the idea of white supremacy and how most of the people implementing that in this area are white. And a lot of people are like, well, we're not hitting anyone. Like, I don't know what you mean by safe. And it's really like that final step. It really starts with yourself. Like, you got to unlearn some stuff. You got to learn what the white supremacy culture is.
You can listen to the 23% every other Tuesday on KMUD, where I highlight the problems and solutions of Humboldt's communities of color. Do you have a story? Are you someone I should talk to? Reach out to the show at the23%@gmail.com. Now back to my interview with Monique.
That representation is so important. And that's why when we met, I was like, well, this is what it's like here, because we want to decolonize these spaces. And I felt like you could do that.
Understanding that. What do you think is the biggest challenge I'll face being here as a journalist?
I will say that the audience can get rough here. The way people respond, and they don't have any fear in letting you know that they don't rock with what you say, or that what you're doing, even if there's a whole population of people that are like, you are saving my life right now, that is an issue for their community. And they have no problem calling, emailing, hitting those comment chat boxes, even just advertising our events on certain platforms have led to being harassed. That was me being harassed as Black Humble, where there's a community of us, right? Whereas you are here, not alone, but certainly not in the same respect as like a known organization. And so knowing that people have also been attacked in this community, there's been hate crimes in our elementary schools, like just knowing that that exists here also always puts a fear in me for people that are making space to call people out, say what needs to be said, and platforming Black and brown voices.
Oh,
created this show to serve Humble by highlighting these underrepresented communities. Reflecting on what Mo said and what I've experienced living here, by not taking action to fix the system that birthed our problems, her fears are valid.
That was an excerpt of Black Humboldt from reporter Kelby McIntosh's show, The 23%. Kelby is part of the California Local News Fellowship at UC Berkeley, reporting for Access Humboldt. And you can hear the full story at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.